You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Cerebral Entanglements: How the Brain Shapes Our Public and Private Lives. The author is Alan J. Hamilton. The book cover has five rows of three brain scan images depicted in various pastel colors. The reviewer is Deborah Bloom. Can understanding the brain make us better people? In Cerebral Entanglements, Alan J. Hamilton argues that new imaging technologies give us unprecedented access with revolutionary implications. There is a photograph of a sculpture of a brain made of rose-colored fibers. The caption reads, "New imaging technologies," writes Alan J. Hamilton, "may make us the first generation able to image and quantify human thought." The human brain, it's amazing. A master conductor of our emotional symphonies, a supercomputer of intelligence, a treasure inside the temple of the skull, where it gloriously shimmers, vivid, vital, jewel-like. I mean, is it any wonder we're such a special species? Sorry, I had to get that out of my system. Books built on hyperbole seem to bring out the worst in me, and Cerebral Entanglements, a new book by the surgeon and medical consultant Alan J. Hamilton, is so breathlessly excited about our brains and how they work, about the dazzle of new insights and technologies, that occasionally this reader felt compelled to take a break and fan herself. On the other hand, if you're the kind of person who enjoys hearing the brain described as the holy of holies, the chemistry of human relationships as finding treasure on the map of love, and happiness as a good wine, then disregard my reaction. Obviously, I'm not that kind of person. Still, in the interest of fairness, I'll also tell you that Hamilton's tour of all things brain does have its charms and virtues. A friendly writing style, a core of moral decency, and a wide-ranging wealth of research to back up his points. Cerebral Entanglements sprawls across many different fields that investigate how we, and our busy brains, engage with the world, neuroscience, endocrinology, history, culture, psychology, moral philosophy. Well, you get the idea. New technologies allow us to visually illuminate the brain as it encounters myriad issues and challenges. This means, Hamilton argues, that we are the first generation to be able to image and quantify human thought, an idea to justify some exuberance, you might say, and in the 300-odd pages of his book, he does his best not to miss a single thought of importance. Of this bounty, I particularly liked his compassionate exploration of the way children's brains are altered by trauma and neglect. Hamilton underlines the impact of such experiences by citing studies which show a negative effect even on fetal development if a pregnant woman is exposed to violence. There's an insightful look at what brain imaging and neurochemistry research has shown us about how grief, loss, and depression can reshape the brain, changing both its physical structure and chemical function. The book includes a series of functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, depictions of the brain as it responds to situations ranging from stress to injury. These are fascinating and powerful. I studied and restudied one of a patient suffering from PTSD. The image read as a bomb on a timer, lit by brain regions sparking with fear and rage. But despite such examples, or as Hamilton puts it, such heady stuff, I did not find myself swept away by his assurance that we are now drivers at the wheel of the brain car, so to speak. When he writes, "The brain is the master editor of reality," I'm not sure exactly what he means. Similarly, when he proposes that imaging technology now allows us to see wisdom's shape and form, it's unclear to me that we've learned how to define wisdom, to see it clearly, or even to practice it in a meaningful way. Although Hamilton is prone to such sweeping statements, he also occasionally admits some limits. In a section on the subconscious, he acknowledges that the brain rarely works the way we think it does or should. Later, while examining the mind-body connection, he writes, "We think we have sound logical explanations about the way the brain should be organized, but we are almost always wrong." Yes, the human brain is beautiful, remarkable, and powerful. And it's true that researchers have brought us closer than ever to mapping its structure, deciphering the chemistry and electrical signals that zing through our nervous systems, helping us better understand what drives human behaviors at their best and worst. But the brain has yet to yield all of its mysteries. In his conclusion, Hamilton expresses the hope we can use our hard-acquired knowledge of the human self to reinforce our more compassionate behaviors and possibly bring more kindness to a world that desperately needs it. This reviewer, cranky as she may be, hopes for the same. The reviewer, Deborah Blum, is the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT and the author of The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Quest for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. The following is a review of the Paddington Bear films based on Thomas Michael Bond's book series. The reviewer is Rachel Sherman. Grieving with Paddington. A newly mourning daughter finds an unexpected companion in the beloved films whose star, a little bear, sets an example of how to live with loss. There's a picture that depicts Paddington Bear wearing only his iconic red hat and a tag on a string hanging around his neck. He is looking at the camera with an enigmatic look in what looks like perhaps a train station. It was on the flight home from my father's funeral that I first met Paddington. In search of an easy watch to take our minds off things, my partner David and I thought a movie about the adventures of a CGI bear in a floppy red hat might do the trick. We went in cold, neither of us having grown up with the children's books. If you're familiar with the story, you'll know this was a naive, if not poor, decision in a time of grief. Almost immediately, Paddington, already an orphan, loses his uncle Pastuzo in a cataclysmic earthquake in Peru. Soon after, his aunt Lucy tells him that he must find a new home, alone, without her. Orphaned doubly in the first 10 minutes, I began to cry. Since I was a child, I had been consumed with my father's needs and longed not to be the parent to my parent. Poor Paddington, forced to navigate the world of adults. The Paddington films have acted as a strange benchmark. At 31, I watched the first movie the day after laying my father to rest in a pine box, and the sequel, which was pure delight and offered a reprieve from the darkness of mourning, a few months later. By the time Paddington in Peru, the third movie, is released on February 14th in the United States, it will be nearly 2 years since my father passed. The series has become an unexpected grief tracker. Paddington, my fortuitous companion. My father and I had at best a complicated relationship, as he had with just about everyone. An addict with more than a few mental health disorders and later dementia, he'd burn bridges with anyone who tried to offer that fleeting, suffocating thing called help. There were years of unemployment, stints in rehab, bouts of disappearances, and countless emergency room visits. I thought I had pre-grieved, to borrow a term from Roman Roy, so the ripples of hopelessness and thoughts of what's the point of it all that followed his death arrived as a sick aftershock. I was emptied. On the plane, as I watched this innocent little bear, with his unshakable optimism and impeccable manners, experience loss after loss, that emptiness grew until it blackened the whole of me from the inside out. I'd been tricked by a children's film. David reached out to hold my hand. Aunt Lucy tells Paddington that he must go to London, the birthplace of an explorer she and Uncle Pastuzo once hosted. She places a luggage tag around Paddington's neck that says, "Please take care of this bear." I winced, wishing someone would do the same for me. But Paddington protests. He doesn't know anyone in London. There was once a war in the explorer's country, Aunt Lucy gently explains. Thousands of children were sent away for safety, left at railway stations with tags around their necks, and unknown families took them in and loved them like their own. This time, I wasn't the only one trying to hold it together. David, a grandson of two Holocaust survivors, turned to me, and we erupted in sobs. We paused the film and leaned our foreheads together, weeping, letting our shoulders rattle the tray tables as we convulsed. David's paternal grandmother, his Safta, Frieda Schindling, escaped the war in 1939 via the Kinder Transport, the rescue operation that brought nearly 10,000 children from Nazi-occupied Europe to England. Frieda, 14, boarded a train alone, leaving behind her parents and older sister. All were killed in the concentration camps. In London, Frieda was sent to an orphanage and later adopted by an English couple who raised her as their own, an unfathomable gift. The Kinder Transport was a relatively small operation, rescuing a fraction of the children facing death, and was cut short by Hitler's invasion of Poland. Seeing it referenced in a movie unrelated, or so we thought, to the Holocaust left us stunned. Paddington, eyes glossed over in despair, asks, "What if they don't even like bears?" Aunt Lucy reassures him that the good people of London will not have forgotten how to treat a stranger. As David and I learned, the author, Michael Bond, based Paddington on the refugee children with tags around their necks, and he as a child watched arrive at the train station in Reading, just outside London. When our hero arrives on the platform at Paddington, the station he gets his name from, he asks, "Does anyone know where I can find a home?" He, too, is taken in by kind strangers in London, the Brown family, though not without reserve. Mr. Brown, played by Hugh Bonneville, sees Paddington as a safety hazard. Neighbors are skeptical, some fearful of the new addition. Strangers roll their eyes. They pick and choose who is deserving of their compassion. But Mrs. Brown, Sally Hawkins, accepts his fur and quirky hygiene habits wholeheartedly. She is a match for Paddington's own disposition, benevolence. And set to the joyful music of a calypso band, he soon befriends others with similar backgrounds, like Mr. Gruber, Jim Broadbent, an eccentric antiques dealer whose arrival in London sounds awfully familiar. At the antique shop, overflowing with bronze sculptures and ornate lamps, a train snakes through to dispense tea. Paddington follows in awe. "Just like a train I was on many years ago," Mr. Gruber tells him. "There was trouble in my country, so my parents sent me all the way across Europe. I was not much older than you are now." Paddington peers into the rail car to find a small boy, scared and alone, a label around his neck. David and I pause to cry some more. The Jewish themes kept coming. Paddington is a stowaway on a boat. How my own grandfather Saul was said to have escaped pogroms in Poland before the war. Paddington written off as a most unpleasant creature, in complaints by nosy neighbors. Paddington escaping death from a vampy, taxidermy-obsessed Nicole Kidman, while trapped in an incinerator surrounded by flames. When the credits rolled, David and I held on to each other, bleary-eyed, blindsided. Later in the year, when the grief was fresh but not raw, we watched the sequel. This time we were not so green. We knew to expect a gut punch and braced accordingly. But any heaviness was immediately tempered by Paddington's usual antics and a new villain, a delightfully silly Hugh Grant with a penchant for elaborate disguises and magic tricks. With its Wes Anderson-like whimsy and escape capers, it is my and many others' favorite of the three. In it, Paddington has happily settled onto London and the routines of life with the Browns. My own life hadn't settled in quite the same way. My living situation was in limbo, my health a mess. But it was moving in that direction, and it was a comfort to see my fellow wanderer had found his way. I was rooting him on, and maybe rooting for myself, too. Paddington's perpetual assumption of goodwill disarms even the most hardened of criminals, earning him allies at every turn. Here was Paddington with an entourage of friends. Here was Paddington getting a job, albeit one he promptly loses. Here was Paddington sleeping easily each night, knowing he is loved. I, still clinging to bitterness and self-pity, envied his sense of belonging, but there was also hope quietly peeking through. With Paddington in Peru, time has worked its miraculous alchemy. Nearly 2 years have passed since the funeral. This movie, the third of the series, is centered on Paddington's return trip to his native Peru with the Browns in tow. The Calypso band is traded in for a cumbia ensemble, and its up-tempo chica chica beats a reminder that I am no longer sodden with despair. It helps, too, that the film is replete with hijinks even more ridiculous than the others. Olivia Colman, wearing a nun's habit and wielding a guitar, plays the baddie. Antonio Banderas is a swaggering, gold-crazy ship captain. Still, I cried at the opening. A flashback to baby Paddington all on his own, clutching a log in a perilous river, and at the end, which shows Paddington with his bear tribe in present day. I couldn't help but think of David Safta, what she would have given to see her family again, to take a group photo. David and I are getting married later this year. We'll exchange vows under a huppah with white linens that belong to Safta. My dad won't be there to walk me down the aisle. Even if he were alive, the truth is that I don't know if I would invite him. His demons were contagious. The beauty of mourning, with the advantage of hindsight, is to be able to take the admirable and leave the rest. Individual grief, so entwined with intergenerational sorrow, can feel like an inheritance passed down to harden the heart. But what Paddington perhaps offers above all else is choice. The choice to be gracious and to extend grace. The choice to resist the urge towards selective compassion. The choice to disrupt, against all odds, cycles of suffering. Paddington doesn't gorge on sadness, as I've been known to do. His story is one of resilience. The reviewer, Rachel Sherman, writes across multiple sections of the New York Times and has a special interest in subcultures, misfits, and oddball tales. Nesting by Roisin O'Donnell. The book cover shows a black raven in flight against a purple and sunset-colored sky. The reviewer is Katie J. M. Baker. The nightmare of leaving an abusive marriage. The heroine of Roisin O'Donnell's novel, Nesting, is a young mother desperate to escape her husband's physical and emotional control. There is a picture, drawn in hues of blue crayon and watercolor, depicting a woman sitting at the edge of the bed, her knees drawn up, looking out of the window contemplatively. There are two children sound asleep in the bed. Nesting, Roisin O'Donnell's gripping debut novel, contains all the twists and turns of a classic thriller. But its heroine, Ciara, isn't trying to solve a mystery or a murder. She's a housewife struggling to cut ties with her abusive husband. Ryan is the type of man who other women sneak glances at when he's acting the part of the loyal, hard-working father on the beach or at the playground. In the privacy of their home, he terrorizes Ciara, and she knows she has to leave. But where can she go? Ciara lives in Dublin amid a housing crisis in 2018. She has no friends because Ryan cut her off from them. And she can't flee to her mother and sister in England because Ryan will not grant her permission to take their daughters, aged 4 and 2, out of the country. And with what money? Ciara has none and no way to earn any. When they married, Ryan insisted Ciara quit her job as a teacher, claiming she couldn't work in Ireland because she didn't speak Irish, which Ciara later learns was a lie. Where will Ciara and the children sleep if not in Ryan's home? How will they buy groceries if not with the money that Ryan doles out to her? Ciara isn't sure she's even capable of thinking for herself anymore. For years, she has been cut off from the world, she realizes. Her head floods with that uneasy feeling of having lost track of her own mind. That Ciara's struggles are endured by so many victims of domestic violence makes them no less suspenseful than the travails of a detective or assassin or spy. Nesting is tense and propulsive from the very beginning, when Ciara learns she is pregnant. She has tried to leave Ryan before, when her younger daughter was just a few weeks old, but didn't manage to stay away for long. This time, Ciara bolts on instinct, grabbing laundry off the line and buckling her children into her car without much of a plan. While she waits for subsidized housing, Ciara secures temporary emergency lodging through city services in a run-down hotel, one room for their soon-to-be family of four, with no hot plate to cook on and no fridge for their groceries. The front desk warns her that she'll be kicked out if she fails to check in before 8 every night, or if the hotel reaches full capacity. Ciara also manages to find a teaching job, but it's on a probationary basis, and she's not always able to prepare for class because of sick children and pregnancy complications. Leaving is one thing, but staying away is another, a victim of domestic violence tells Ciara. She knows it would, in many ways, be easier to give up and return home. After all, Ciara reminds herself, Ryan has never actually hit her. His abuse comes in nearly every other form, emotional, financial, sexual. But home also means pasta bakes, bath toys, warm laundry, even happy memories with Ryan that Ciara is unable to shake. She isn't sure what is worse for her daughters in the long term, living in a cramped hotel room or growing up believing that the way their father treats their mother is normal and okay. Aside from a heavy-handed side plot about vulnerable hatchlings that I found distracting and contrived, Nesting is immersive and emotional. I rooted for Ciara as she scrambled to find stable housing, keep her job, and make new friends. I agonized as she tried to potty train, breastfeed, and celebrate Christmas all in one drab and tiny hotel room. And I raged at Ryan's endless mind games and predations, especially when he and Ciara face off against each other in court. Ciara is desperate for full custody, but unable to articulate the extent of Ryan's abuse to a judge because she's still processing it herself, which gives Ryan an opening to exploit Ciara's trauma and financial precarity. He argues that she is unhinged and irrational for raising their children in an unsafe situation and demands his parental rights as a father. But he shirked his parental duties when Ciara still lived at home, and she finds it impossible to imagine that he will be capable of caring for their children during the overnight visits he is fighting for. Will he unintentionally harm them, or will he intentionally harm them to get his revenge if Ciara won't agree to get back together? Is it safer for them to reunite? Like every worthy thriller, Nesting keeps the reader guessing until the end. It is rare and refreshing to read a satisfyingly suspenseful novel that exists in such a domestic sphere, a quiet world of Duplos and nursing bras, daycares, and playrooms, instead of dark alleys and underworld. The reviewer, Roisin O'Donnell, is an award-winning Irish author. She was the winner of the Irish Book Award for Short Story of the Year 2018. Victorian Psycho, a novel by Virginia Feito. The book cover has a picture of a blue-eyed little girl with hair that is shoulder-length, sandy-colored and wavy, wearing a headband made of leaves and red berries. She has a serious look and is a portrait of innocence. The reviewer is Jack Jempk. Is Winfred's evil innate or inherited? Is her vengeance against the class and gender discriminations of her era warranted? With the bloodbath that ensues, Fado leaves the reader wondering if the distinction matters at all. Fado's deliciously macabre novel about a murderous 19th century governess announces its narrator's grisly intentions from the start. In 3 months, everyone in this house will be dead, she announces a few pages in. Any attempt to justify the actions of a psychopath would be futile, but Fado does reveal that the young Winfred suffered willful neglect and harm by her own caretakers, including her mother, and that she has a specific score to settle with this household in particular. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.